broadcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good morning, good afternoon, whatever time it is. Hey, next week it's going to change, isn't it? Yep, next week it's, well, it's not going to change for us. We're just, it's going to be the same time for us, different time for you all, I guess. I don't know, and you know what, don't care. But hey, you know, you can figure it out. You're the ones that play with your clocks. I figure if you can figure out how to set it, then you can figure out what time other things are. Didn't they lose yesterday? No, they won yesterday. The Redskins won yesterday. Who'd they beat? You have no idea. Oh, okay. Doesn't matter. All that matters is last night, truth and justice prevailed, and the Giants defeated the Cowboys. That was the only important important thing that happened. Yes, indeed. It's good to be back for at least a few programs. We'll be here Tuesday and Thursday of this week. We'll be here Tuesday of next week. And then the big conference, the big debate, the cruise, and everything kicks off. And let me tell you, we are in the middle of crunch time, halfway through. I thought there was going to be a little bit more to have been done by now, but of course, a week ago yesterday was a non-show. And let me mention, for those of you who are coming to the conference or maybe have sort of been thinking about it, but maybe Indianapolis beat Washington, so the Skins lost. So, oh well. Okay. Hey, I'm just mentioning that some guy across the window has a Redskins hat on. He put it on right as the program started.
And see, I'm not a fair weather fan. Even good times and bad times, I'm a fan.
But that if you said they won, then you'd be in denial. You'd that's be a denial true. Fan. You'd be a fan that's in a fantasy.
What do you think a fair weather fan or a consistent fan is? You know, it's like, you know, the Browns, the dog pound always win, no matter how bad the Browns were, you know.
I don't think there is such a fan like that for the Cardinals, though. Because after 18 years...
Why do you think I live in Phoenix and I'm wearing a Washington Redskins hat?
Let me tell you something.
You know, the curse of the Cardinals is I grew up being a fan of this team, and the Cardinals moved to town, and I can't watch them anymore, so that's how I have a hard time even keeping track of their scores and what happens in their games, because... Well, you know, got to watch the Cardinals.
And I think if they continue playing the way they're playing, that's going to stop. the local stations aren't going to want to carry that anyways. And
well,
again,
they have to, I think.
I don't know if they have to.
But. Well, because it's network national, you know.
Who knows? Who cares? All I know is whenever you play the Cardinals, you never have to give up hope. No matter how far
behind
you
are. That's a fact.
That's right. They could be up 72-0, and they will find a way to lose a game.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of other sports you could watch if you just wanted to watch a guy get chased around a grassy field all day long, you know. And it doesn't matter how good of a quarterback you are. If you play for the Cardinals, you better run like Fran Tarkenton, pal, because you're gonna get chased.
Oh man, I'll tell you that Bears game was. But I thought it was really nice the Cardinals to let the Raiders win. I mean, the Raiders have really been taking a lot of heat. They're supposed to be these nasty guys, and they hadn't won any, so the Cardinals just felt bad for them and let them win. So anyway, why
so
in the world?
You saying it was grace?
It was grace. Well, they've got nothing to lose, so why not help somebody else out? I mean, come on. You might as well, you know, I don't think they should have been on the field with a high school team on Sunday, so they would have gotten whacked. But anyhow, that's neither here nor there. I was trying to mention that next week at the conference, if you're planning on going to the conference, I was talking about this, and then he throws this Redskins hat on. I don't know why he's throwing a Redskins hat on. And he had this grin on his face, like it meant something. I'm going to put this hat on because they lost again. Anyway, at the conference, what we're going to do is on Thursday night, when we had an open invitation to Ergen Kanter, who, to my knowledge, never even bothered to respond, to that invitation. But on Thursday evening, we will be Tom Askell and myself will we will do the presentations that we would have done. Now, I'm not going to say it's identical. We're not going to limit ourselves to an exact amount of same exact amount of time and things like that. But there were certain issues that both of us would love to have had the opportunity of enunciating to the students. And I've had at least one guy I can think of who has said it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter how you were treated. It wouldn't matter how unfair it was. It wouldn't matter how if you were mocked or anything. You still should have gone. So I guess he thinks that you should like go to Peter Ruckman's April Fool's Day presentations and stuff like that, and just put your position out there to be mocked and ridiculed. And when you start to make a point, they can turn off your mic and ha 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 and throw stuff at you. I don't know. But anyway, you know what happened with the debate. We're not going to go back over that. That's a done deal, and the documentation's out there, and you can think what you want about it. But we're going to do the presentations that we would have done and talk about the things we would have talked about, answer the objections that Ergun Canner and Emir Canner. In fact, I'm going to try to track down the Emir Canner sermon from the Thomas Road Baptist Church. Maybe I can have some clips on that on my tablet. We can hook it into the sound system and use it that way and play the clips and respond to the things that are said, the charges of hyper-Calvinism and things like that on a Thursday evening. And then, of course, what I'd like to do is then make the MP3s of that available and get the word out to all of our friends at Liberty University. Those folks that are sort of like the underground resistance during the war in Europe, and we'll put out the secret coded message on the side channel to let them know that this MP3 download is available, and make it available to students at Liberty University so that they can at least hear what would have been said, and also along with that the fact that their champion there has declined numerous challenges to debate one-on-one and neutral ground. And I noticed that a number of folks have been commenting on the link that I provide on the blog where you can see some scholastic debates and collegiate debate. And you're watching these people that look like they're hyperventilating, talking 350 to 400 words per minute. And that's the kind of thing that Brett O'Donnell's teams at Liberty are very adept at doing. That is not what you do in theological debate. That's not how you communicate the truth of God. That's not how you discuss the Word of God and exegete the Word of God and handle the Word of God. You instead make clear presentations where you're attempting to connect with your audience and bring them along so that they can see why you object to the other side, and they can see that you are the consistent side. And that's what both Bill Shishko and I attempted to do on Thursday evening there on Long Island up in Port Jeff, and I think that's exactly what took place. We are attempting to get hold of the recordings even as we speak. We would very much like to have at least the audio recordings available. And then the plan then is to take two different video sources that were made that night, and we have the ability anyway to put them together, to edit them together into one product, and then sync up the audio from the church itself with that, and that should provide a real very useful DVD of the debate as well. It went very, very well. And people have asked me, how come you haven't talked about the debate on the blog? Well, I let you know that it went well. I don't feel any particular compulsion to go back over any of the particular issues, because until a person has listened to the debate and can do actually what Bill Shishko always suggests people do when he moderates the great debates every year, he has exhorted the people listening to flowchart the debate, to put down the major points and the statements and the answers and flowchart them. And that's especially useful for not only following the arguments, but also, and this to me is if you want my one comment on the debate, this to me is the debate. This to me is the issue that was, I think, clearly presented in the debate. And that is, In my opening statement, I said it is your job as the audience to examine each side for consistency, for exegetical consistency and argumentational consistency, to see whose position is consistent with itself, and most importantly, whose position is consistent exegetically with the very same kind of hermeneutical type of argumentation that we utilize to discuss the resurrection, justification, the Trinity, the deity of Christ, whatever else it may be, those areas where the two sides agree. What is the exegetical, the hermeneutical method that we utilize to come to those conclusions? And then does one side use a different hermeneutical method on the subject of baptism? And to me, that was the debate. That was the issue of the debate. And what makes a good debate is that everyone will be able, I believe, to examine both sides on that issue, because there was nothing personal in the debate. There was no there was nothing to get in the way of you being able to do what you need to do for this debate to give you the answer to that particular question. That's what makes it an excellent debate. As you know, there are some debates where the opponent just behaves so reprehensibly and so out of, in such an out of control fashion, that you really can't do that. You only hear one side. The other side really hasn't engaged the issue. That obviously was not the case here, and therefore you are able to make that those kinds of decisions. So we will get that available as quickly as we possibly can. Because we know a lot of folks are going to be very desirous of listening to that particular debate. And once again, I would like to see that debate make the rounds also at certain universities as a demonstration of how brothers in Christ can disagree on important and vital issues and believe that their disagreement is in fact itself important to how the church functions and things like that. And yet do so without any of the rancor and nastiness that marks certain other encounters. And so I think that those who are Baptists, who have never heard a case for infant baptism, and there are many, most Reformed Baptists have, because most Reformed Baptists have had to deal with this issue anyway. Most Reformed Baptists who know their Calvinistic heritage have had to read Calvin and stuff like that, so it's not like we're ignorant of it. But on both sides, you have Presbyterians who think that all Baptists are sort of like, you know, the fundamentalist Baptist down the street that just baptizes because, you know, because John the Baptist did it that way and he was the first Baptist. And they've never heard a Reformed Baptist address the issue of baptism from that perspective. And the same on the other side. There are Baptists that have no idea how a Reformed view of paedobaptism differs from a Lutheran view of paedobaptism, which differs from a Roman Catholic view of paedobaptism. Hey, if you baptize your children, you're all just thrown into one big camp, and so both sides, I think, will go, wow, hadn't ever thought of it that way before. And there were a lot of people debate who were also going, I've learned something this evening. I had never really consider those issues before. And so that's going to be great. And once again, I think we've had the opportunity, you know, I think about last year, we've got some debates that just, I can't think of anybody else who has the same kinds of debates available that we do. I mean, the John Dominic Crossan thing, we've got to get the Marcus Borg thing, the Crossan Borg thing out. And it's been over a year now. And we've just got to get that stuff put out there. Those kinds of things are just really unique, especially from the perspective that we come at it from, and so we'll be getting that stuff out there, and you'll I think you'll be very blessed by that. So conference coming up, and then of course the debate with John Shelby Spong to sort of wrap up the Pulpit Crimes Conference, which is very appropriate on many levels, and then of course continuing with those themes on the cruise as well, and so take a slight deep breath after Long Island, but very, very short deep breath, and then head directly into the next stretch there. And then I'm only home about 2 weeks before we're going to be in St. Louis, St. Charles again, this time on Sola Scriptura at Covenant of Grace Church with Van Lees and the folks there for our almost annual, I think it pretty much is an annual trip now to St. Louis first weekend in December and the conference there. So that's what we've got coming up right now. Going to be teaching for Golden Gate in January on apologetics and also headed out to New Jersey at some point during January. I think it's the third weekend for an apologetics conference weekend down there. And then the whole new year starts, and it goes by just as fast as 2006 did. In fact, probably a little bit faster. This Thursday, my plan, given that we have upcoming the Reformation Sunday celebrations in certain churches, I may well be taking the opportunity to, on Thursday, talk a little bit about the background of the Reformation, the various, I've always found it fascinating, the movements of God pre-existing the Reformation that feed into the Reformation, how you have the pre-Reformation reformers like Wycliffe and Huss, and you have really the necessity of the invention of the printing press so that the Reformation can really take place. And you have Erasmus, a fascinating fellow, who I think is vilified by many and also made a saint by many, and he was, you know, sort of somewhere in between there. A lot of folks don't know much about Erasmus and where he was coming from. But anyway, might take some time on Thursday to go over some of those fascinating historical aspects that go into the Reformation, which a few folks, not many, sadly, I think the vast majority of evangelicals today, if you ask them anything about Martin Luther, would say he was a reformer in the 1960s, actually, and they wouldn't really have a whole lot of an idea of what the Reformation was actually all about, and even less passion for the beliefs that were a part thereof. So with all of that said, what I'd like to do today is I would like to... I didn't know she had said that. I would like, oh, by the way, see our little cough button here, Rich? That's the exact same cough button they have at the radio station on Long Island. And that's the only thing they have the same there. Because everything else we have was created at least four decades after everything else they have there. I was in some old radio stations when my dad was chief engineer of WHP in Harrisburg. And I've been around some old equipment, and it is all found.
They're still using carts and stuff?
Oh, that place is, oh, my goodness.
Tube technology that works.
The whole nine yards, man. It is absolutely ancient, just incredible. I didn't even have a button to mute me, but there was one of these.
Now, the big question is, remember years ago when we started out on XEG?
Yeah.
The train tracks? You remember the train tracks outside the window, and the train would go by in the middle of the show?
Yeah, well, there were no train tracks outside there, though. I was told the story, I forget who it was, that they had finished the program up, and they were walking out, and the guy mowing the lawn, he says, "That guy looks like the DJ." And Chris goes, "That is the DJ." So it was.
We'll let you have a microphone if you'll mow the lawn.
If you'll mow the lawn, that's right. There you go. That's how it works. So, anyway, it was. we are blessed with that those things in there with LEDs and stuff like that. And we're quite blessed to have all that stuff in there. It's no two ways about it. So anyway, what I'd like to do today is get back to what I promised I would get to, and that is looking at the Dr. Vine's sermon. I've already noticed, of course, that in the blogosphere, if you have in any way, shape, or form responded to the sermon at First Baptist Church Woodstock a week ago Sunday night, that was specifically designed to immunize the church against Reformed theology, if you have even bothered to say that it misrepresents the subject that it's attempting to address, you're automatically attacking Dr. Vines. Now, obviously, if you were to use the same kind of reasoning in reverse, then you would say that Dr. Vines was personally attacking every Calvinist by misrepresenting their position. And I would think there would actually be more reason to say that than the reverse. But be that as it may, it is once again, yet again, another example of the fact that very few people today think in a critical fashion. What I mean by that is I was told yesterday by a fellow in our chat channel that he had given one of my books, The Potter's Freedom, to one of his elders, and one of his elders had commented that he felt I was attacking Norman Geisler. Now, he's not the first person to have said that, but as I mentioned to him, I've had many people say that. I have not had a single person substantiate that. It's real easy to make the assertion, but then when you say, okay, and could you give me an example of this? Could you show me this in the text? Could you give me a page number? Could you give me a paragraph? Could you quote it in context? All of a sudden, the wheels fall off, and you discover very quickly that for many people, simply disagreeing with someone because of their stature is to attack them. And I think that's probably true with a lot of people themselves. I think maybe Dr. Geisler believes that I simply attacked him by disagreeing with him and, in fact, documenting errors on his part. I guess for some people, you don't do that. You simply don't document errors on the part of a Christian leader. Dr. Vines has been the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. And so evidently what that means is once you have obtained that position, that afterwards you sort of have a special get out of the requirement to accurately represent the topics you're addressing card, and anything you say from that point on, now anybody else can still disagree with you, but they can't say that you're actually misrepresenting anything. And as I mentioned the last time we were together on a week ago this coming Thursday, it was over a week ago, 2 weeks ago this coming Thursday, when we were last together, The fact is there seems to be a singular template, one template that is sort of floating around. Even Dr. Vines at the beginning of the sermon says, I'm working from a manuscript tonight, and I've never done that in 50 years of preaching. Well, why would he have to do that? Well, because there are certain points that he wants to cover, and they're not overly familiar to him. And when we start listening to them, they're the same old, and they are the same old that are surface level. They're the same old arguments that have been refuted over and over again. And that any person who wants to honestly address the issue would know this and hence could not repeat these points without, while repeating them, addressing the responses that have been offered. But that's not what happens, because if you start doing that, then the people listening to you are going to realize that there's actually two sides to this issue, and evidently that's the one thing that everybody wants to avoid doing. And so it is disappointing when people who are in positions of religious authority, when they simply go with the flow, go with prepackaged presentations that are grossly inaccurate, that does not show respect for the people who hold those positions. You're not showing respect for the pulpit you're standing behind. You're not showing respect for your audience. You must think that there's no one in your audience who has ever examined this issue so as to recognize that you yourself either haven't or you're treating it in a cavalier fashion. I don't understand that mindset. I will never understand that mindset. And if there are others who just go, well, hey, you know, he has the right to have that mindset because he's been the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. Well, please explain that to me. Explain how that works. I'd like to know from a biblical Christian worldview exactly how it is that having held a particular denominational post releases you from all issues of integrity and accurately handling facts. I don't understand that. I'd like to hear an explanation of that from those who seem to think that in fact is how things should be handled. So it was a fairly lengthy sermon. I don't know how long it's take to get through it. Don't even honestly know, you know, if something else were to all of a sudden come up, we may not. But it again is worthwhile to listen to these things, provide a response. We have a lot of people listening now because of what happened with the non-debate, who were not listening before. And so, we may be repeating some stuff that we have talked about when we've responded to Dave Hunt, when we responded to Norman Geisler, when we responded to Adrian Rogers, and we've responded to, well, just fill in the blanks. There's a whole lot of folks that seemingly pass around the same sermon. And just deliver it with various levels of skill and sometimes various levels of vitriol. I don't really think there's any vitriol in Dr. Vine's presentation. That was a refreshing difference. But the fact of the matter is, it is still the same kind of presentation. So let's take a listen and begin listening to this particular debate.
Now, you're going to have to really pray for me tonight, because I'm going to do something I have not done in over 50 years of my ministry. I'm going to be working tonight off a manuscript, which means I'm going to be reading a great portion of what I've got to say. And I think you will understand why, because of the subject I am dealing with and the controversies which swirl around this particular theme. But it's unnatural to me to do this. I like to have eye contact, and so I've been preaching extemporaneously through the years. You know, preachers are different. Some preach from manuscript. Some preach by letter. Some preach by notes. I preach by letter. I just read back and let her fly. That's kind of the way I normally preach. But this is a little bit different tonight. But I'm going to do my very, very best to handle this in a way that will be helpful and that will assist you in your understanding. This is the second message in a series of messages I'm building around the theme, Baptist Battles. Our last message was Liberalism, a Baptist and his Bible. The message tonight, Calvinism, a Baptist and his election. On the Sunday night, the 22nd of the month, I will bring a message entitled Pentecostalism, a Baptist and his Gifts. And then on the first Sunday morning of November, I will speak on the subject of libertinism, a Baptist and his booze. And so I hope you'll come and we'll hear the rest of these messages. I brought some graphics by for our men today, and I have a lot of scriptures I'm going to use, and they'll be putting these graphics up hopefully as I move along through this particular study this evening. I was pastor of a First Baptist Church in Jacksonville, Florida, as you know, for almost 24 years. During those 24 years, preaching Sunday morning and Sunday night and Wednesday night, I was able to do a series of messages on every book of the Bible, all 66 of the books of the Bible. I gave the church down there a 9-month period of time when I announced my retirement, before I concluded, to hopefully give the pulpit committee time to find God's man for the church. And in those months, that is exactly what happened. Dr. Mac Brunson is now the pastor of the church there. During those 9 months, as they were coming to a close, my father died in the month of August, and over the weekend, we had come to do the funeral of my father and to attend to these particular matters. Just a day or two after I had returned from the death of my father, I received an email from one of the young men in our congregation. He was 1 year old when I came there.
Now let me pause this for just a moment. And once again, what we're going to hear here, I'm not questioning the existence of this email. I'm not questioning Dr. Vine's response to it. But it does seem to be a regular aspect of this discussion that the person who denies and decries Reformed theology always points to some kind of a personal hurt or personal experience that helps to substantiate, well, the resultant prejudice. Now, I have been vilified by Calvinists. I have been attacked by Calvinists. There are mean Calvinists in the world, just as there are mean Arminians and inconsistent evangelicals, and there are mean synergists and mean monergists, and I might be able to argue that being a mean monergist is significantly less consistent than being a mean synergist, but the point is that if you make your decisions about these types of things based upon that kind of argumentation, that kind of experientialism, then you're clearly not engaging in meaningful exegetical study of the text. You're allowing your personal experiences to impact your viewpoint. And it seems to me, especially since he finishes his sermon on this point, and that's a good, by the way, that's a good sermon technique, to tell an engaging story at the beginning, wrap it up at the end. It gives the audience a feeling of completeness in the presentation. It connects things together. It's very, very good as far as pulpiteering is concerned. But it's not necessarily overly good given the nature of this particular presentation.
Saw him come to faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. I married him and his wife. Very active young man in our church. It was probably the ugliest, most unkind email I received in over 50 years of ministry. And in this email, he basically chided me for my failure to preach the whole gospel to the congregation. And he said to me, why have you not, and I'm paraphrasing, why have you not preached to the people the doctrines of grace? Why have you not preached limited atonement? Why have you not brought in, and he named a number of outstanding speakers around the country so our people can hear them? And so I don't think I ever received in all of my ministry a more hurtful email than that one was.
Now, let me just stop again. Now, obviously, I'm not going to judge an email I've never seen or the person who sent it. However, there is no question that I have more than once addressed what we in our circles refer to as cage stage Calvinism. Cage stage Calvinism is that Calvinism that is frequently exhibited by those lacking maturity in the Reformed faith. They are the ones who have the belief that they must get upon their white horse and they must draw their sword and they must gallop at high speed toward the nearest church to attack anyone who would not with them say John Calvin three times with a loving tone. And cage stage Calvinists do more damage than they do good. I understand the zeal that comes with that first recognition of the sovereignty of God and his holiness and my unworthiness, but it is frequently not joined with the resultant sanctification that needs to come with those things that gives one enough maturity to recognize that it was grace that opened your eyes to these things, so it's not going to be your bullishness that's going to open up somebody else's eyes to these things. That's what we call cage stage Calvinism. And maybe this was a young man who has just been exposed to the doctrines of grace, has recognized their biblical nature, the consistency of it, maybe has recognized the inconsistency of so much of the preaching since the position held by Dr. Vines and so many other in his position is an inconsistent one. It is self-contradictory, and a person who comes to believe that you need to be consistent in your theology to honor God and to honor his word finds self-contradiction to be something less than honorable. All of those things may be true, but there is a means by which you approach those things. There is a means by which you speak the truth. And all of us have experienced the cage stage at some point. Sometimes we need to climb back into it for a little while to calm down. But maybe that's what this email is about. I don't know. Then again, I have to ask the question, could anyone approach some of these high leaders in the Southern Baptist Convention and seriously attempt a dialogue about these things? I haven't seen a whole lot of desire on the part of any of these individuals to dialogue about these things. I haven't seen anyone giving a whole lot of indication that they are truly desirous of engaging in meaningful conversation on the subject of the doctrines of grace. And so how would I have seen people respond? For example, the fellow in Channel who mentioned the fact that even my own book, where I bent over backwards to remain focused upon the subject and not upon the person I was reviewing, there have been people who very unfairly and untruthfully have accused me of being mean-spirited and nasty and attacking Norman Geisel. Well, that's just not true. I know my own heart. The Lord knows my own heart, and the Lord knows what was there. And when I challenge people on the subject, they can't back up what they're stating. And so is it possible that maybe it's just the idea that here is a young man, and this was functional in the Geiser situation, there are some folks who, because he says he's been preaching for 50 years, and how could someone who has not preached at all tell me who's been preaching for 50 years that I need to do X, Y, or Z? See? So there's the other element there that needs to be factored in trying to evaluate fairly these kinds of accusations that are all too frequently a part of the discussion.
And I set up an appointment for him to come in. Almost weekly now, and even tonight, our pastor has told me about a family that came to our church today to visit, coming from a church which has had difficulty with the problem of Calvinism. One of the former churches I served, a man came there to be the pastor, began to preach the five basic points of Calvinism, bottom line. The church split right down the middle. He remained in the city and he established another church. It is a problem which we cannot ignore.
Now, once again, church splits. Well, it seems to be part of this template to allege that Calvinism is the problem here, that Calvinism tries to come in and it's the new movement, it's the new thing. And, of course, the historical fact is that that's not the case. The historical fact amongst the Southern Baptists is that is not the case. And yet it is the kind of accusation that you use, along with others, to attempt to paint a movement. And all of this seems to be not so much, I can't believe that these men actually feel that these sermons would in any way, shape, or form be convincing to someone who's actually begun to study the issue. In fact, it would seem to me that they'd have to realize that they are abandoning the field of battle because they know they can't win that battle. It seems to me that these are damage control sermons that are meant to limit who is actually going to be listening to these folks and to create a mindset to where if someone says anything that would seem to indicate they're going this direction, that there's going to be more and more people in the congregation that are going to be quicker to report these folks to the leaders so you can weed them out faster. You can get them out of leadership, and if they're no longer in a position of leadership, they're probably going to go someplace else anyway. And so it really does seem to fall into the category of, well, we can't win this battle in the debate format. We can't win this battle in exegesis. We can't win this battle in writing, at least if we allow the other side to be heard. And so let's try to inoculate our congregations against this movement by poisoning the well. Let's try to poison people's minds against Calvinism. Let's try to do it in a nice way, in the sense we'll say that we have lots of good Calvinist friends and we're not going to just kick them out of the kingdom, but we want to sort of subtly inculcate the idea that Calvinism splits churches and Calvinism is just a side issue and Calvinism is just this and that and the other thing. And hopefully what that'll do is it'll automatically cause these walls to come up as soon as someone hears, well, that sounds like Calvinism. Boop. That's the end of the conversation. That's the end of dialogue. That's the end of discussion. I know my pastor doesn't believe in that. I love my pastor. Therefore, that's it. It can't possibly be true. He knows more of this. He knows more about this stuff than I do. And he knows more about this stuff than you do. And therefore, since he rejects it, I'm going to reject it, and I'm just going to trust him. Now, especially for Baptists, that's a really bad attitude. Look at the Roman Catholics and go, look at that guy. He just believes whatever his priest tells him. Well, take priest out and put pastor in, and what's the difference? Seriously. And so that shouldn't be the way things are, but that seems to be what we're hearing here. Because before even defining the position, we have now had Calvinism has turned this long-time church member that I saw him born and I saw him saved and I married him and all the rest of that stuff. And now he's this nasty Calvinist. And it splits churches and it's a problem. And what other movements are you associating this with? Well, you notice, what are the issues he's talking about? He's talking about liberalism. Now he's talking about Calvinists. Then he's going to talk about the charismatic movement, Pentecostalism, and he's going to finish up on booze. Liberals, Calvinists, charismatics, and alcoholics. You tell me what's being communicated in that particular series of discussions. Which one of these does not belong is the question that we might want to ask in that context.
It is a problem we cannot avoid. It is a problem that we must deal with. Calvinism is a system of theology which has been debated for 400 years, brings into keen focus the relationship between divine sovereignty, the sovereignty of God, and human responsibility, the free will of man. Now, when you face the tension of divine sovereignty and human responsibility, here's the problem. Number one, did God choose us because we chose him? If the answer is yes, then it robs man, or it robs God, of his sovereignty. Or did we choose God because he chose us? If the answer is yes, then it robs us of free will.
Now, again, not only is that overly simplistic, but it's just not accurate. It's overly simplistic in that what is... Stop for a moment. If you're Reformed, and let's say especially if you're in a founders-friendly church or in a Southern Baptist church, you're in this context of trying to promote God's truth and live consistent with God's truth, you should hear immediately where that entire presentation went off track. And where it went off track was it is defining this entire issue in regards to what human beings do. It's starting off, and I guess consistently, and what I mean by that is it is consistent for synergists to be man-centered. A synergist, of course, and I know that the vast majority of my listeners know this, but we get new listeners all the time, so I got to repeat myself. I got to make sure people understand. A synergist is a person who believes that there are two forces, two energies that cooperate together. They don't have to be equal to one another. It doesn't have to be 50-50. It can be 95-5. It can be 99-1. But the point is, you cannot reach the goal of salvation and the accomplishment of salvation without two forces cooperating together to bring that about. And so a synergist could be someone who is 50-50, someone who does put a huge amount of human works and activity into the accomplishment of salvation, or it can be someone who simply limits it to a very small amount, but still God cannot save anyone outside of their free will cooperation. And what you're listening to, the man you're listening to, Dr. Vines, is a synergist. Erigan Kanter is a synergist. Adrian Rogers is a synergist. Norman Geisler is a synergist. Roman Catholicism is synergistic by definition. And these individuals, these movements and groups, present this concept of God's grace being necessary. They're not Pelagians. Pelagius taught that you could be saved outside of God's grace, that God's grace was not necessary unto salvation and obedience. And so every man was a new Adam. They're not Pelagians because they'll all say grace is absolutely necessary, but they're not monergists because they will not confess that grace is sufficient. And that is the great controversy. But it's almost never, ever defined that way by a synergist. Now, it's not that they can argue with the accuracy of the statement. It's just they avoid ever getting into a position where they have to actually answer direct questions to where they'd have to affirm that what I just said was true. See? And so there is the argument between monergism and synergism. And what was just presented to you was not so much monergism versus synergism. I mean, the first one, God's sovereignty, we got close, but it was still based in our choosing of God and why we do that, rather than looking at this issue in a theocentric fashion. That is salvation of God? Is God the one who saves, and does he save in a monergistic fashion? or whether saying that salvation is a mixture of God and man. God's part's absolutely necessary, but in and of itself insufficient outside of the action of the rebel sinner. Now, it would be wonderful if I could find some folks on this side that would define it that way and then defend it that way. We could have a great debate and a great discussion and get into the Word of God and so on and so forth, but it does seem that at times it's next to impossible to find folks that are willing to really engage it on that level.
This is a dilemma. This is a problem which has puzzled the mind of man through the centuries. Not only theologians, but also philosophers. It has been the subject of countless late-night bull sessions in colleges. I remember one night we had a bull session and we were talking about how to reconcile the sovereignty of God and the free will of man. Would you believe that night that I actually resolved it and solved the problem? I've forgotten exactly how I did it, but I had it right that night. I'm not going to solve it for you tonight. I want to give two statements to begin with. Number one, I am not going to attack individuals in this message. I have many friends and there are many sincere Christians who are Calvinists. I'm not dealing with personalities or individuals. I'm dealing with the theology of Calvinism. Number two, what I'm going to say to you tonight is not exhaustive.
Now, let me stop right there and respond to both. He does say that he's going to be dealing with the theology of Calvinism. If I say I am going to be dealing with the theology of Roman Catholicism, I feel a very strong necessity to be very accurate in the representation of what Roman Catholicism says. If I say I'm going to be dealing with the theology of Mormonism or Jehovah's Witnesses or Islam or whatever, I need to do my best. I don't have to be infallible. I may make a mistake. If I make a mistake, then I need to admit I made a mistake. But I have to do the best that I can do to accurately represent what the other side is saying. And I'd like to submit that there is absolutely, positively no reason why anyone, given more than 24 hours of notice and preparation, should not be able to accurately represent the Calvinistic position. And to do so not from secondary sources, not from Dave Hunt, not from Norman Geisler, but to do so from original sources. And yet, that's not what we get. All right? And so he himself specifically has said, I'm going to be dealing with the theology of Calvinism. So when we point out this isn't what we believe, when we point out, for example, the constant drumbeat of trying to make double predestination equal to predestination to life, the exact parallel to predestination unto death, which it is not. But that's what everybody keeps doing. That's what everybody keeps repeating. He's not dealing with the theology of Calvinism. He's dealing with a straw man. And when we criticize that, we have a ground for criticizing that because it's his own claim to be dealing with the theology of Calvinism. Secondly, of course it cannot be exhaustive. It would be nice to hear someone try a little fuller response than a single sermon, but that's understandable. However, if you're not going to be exhaustive, you still have to be accurate. Now, I'm going to tell you, it's a whole lot harder to be accurate when you have a very limited amount of time. That's what debates are all about. But the fact of the matter is, that just means you have to work the harder.
I will not deal with every scripture which is used on both sides of the issue, nor will I address every logical argument, pro or con.
Understandable. However, hopefully you will at least attempt to deal with the primary texts that are utilized. And if you try to deal with the primary texts, you will at least do so in such a way that demonstrates that you have listened to the other side and that even if you disagree, your conclusions take into consideration the best arguments that the other side has to present.
Speaking to a church congregation, I'm speaking to a group of people tonight among whom are people of all levels of spiritual growth and maturity. And what I'm really trying to do at the request of our pastor is to lay this matter before you so that you will understand and that you will have some grasp of what we're talking about when we deal with the matter of Calvinism. Now, as I indicated to you last week, our final authority is the Bible. That's why liberalism is such a very, very important issue, because we believe that the Bible is the final authority for all faith and practice. The Reformers called it sola scriptura, scripture alone. For us, the Bible is beneath us, providing the foundation for our faith. It is around us, providing boundaries for our faith. It is within us, informing and growing our faith. It is above us, guiding our faith. What we are after is a biblical theology. What we want to know is, what does the Bible have to say about these issues?
No disagreements with anything there. That's exactly what we hope to be able to hear.
Now, you're going to have to really pray for me tonight, because I'm going to do something I have not done in over 50 years.
That was the non-pause button. That was instead the restart the whole thing button. And that's a bad thing.
This is a dilemma. This is a problem which has puzzled the mind of man. I'm not going to solve it for you tonight. Every logical argument, pro or con. As I indicated to you last week, our final authority is the Bible. That's why liberalism is such a very, very important issue, because we believe that for us, the Bible is beneath us, providing the foundation for our faith.
Sorry about this.
Now, the first thing I'm going to do is just briefly give you some historical introduction. I'm going to share with you just...
I always get scary when the historical introduction starts, because the historical introduction so often ends up coming from sources like Dave Hunt or something, and it just, you get...
In a brief, very survey, cursory fashion, an overview of the historical roots of Calvinism. Some would call it Reformed theology. Others would refer to it as the doctrines of grace. John Calvin was a theologian of 16th century Reformation. When we think about the Reformation, we think in particular about Martin Luther. Martin Luther's primary emphasis was upon justification by faith alone, that we are declared righteous by our faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Calvin's emphasis was on the sovereignty of God. Both Luther and Calvin drew heavily upon Augustine, the first real Roman Catholic.
Boom. Boom. First clear indication that somebody's using what love is this. That's where this is coming from most people today, is let's shoot the Augustine stuff out there. Let's ignore what he said on grace. Let's focus on what he said about the church, even though it would be the materials on grace and his anti-Pelagian writings that Calvin would be citing from. It would be the Catholics who were citing from his anti-Donatist writings. But let's not worry about any of that, because certainly Dave Hunt didn't bother to worry about any of that either.
Augustine was responding to Pelagius in much of his writing. Pelagius, who believed that you could, through good works, earn or merit your salvation. And in contrast to that, Augustine set forth the Bible truth that we are not saved by our works.
Notice the contradiction. Why bother saying this part, which was true, when you just said the other part about Roman Catholicism? Why throw out the the well poisoning statement from Hunt when you're then going to make this statement, which is what, of course, Calvin would have been citing. So I just don't understand that. And honestly, if these folks would have more dialogue and discussion with people who could challenge them on these things, maybe they wouldn't do this kind of thing. But they insulate themselves. My experience is that the leaders are very insulated. As soon as you raise this issue, the walls come up, the doors close, you're mean, you're nasty, you're trying to divide us, you're trying to get us off track, blah, 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 blah.
For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it is the gift of God. So Calvin built on this, and he developed a systematic theology which he put together in his volumes, The Institutes of the Christian Religion. His student, Theodore Beza, carried some of the doctrines and the theology of Calvin further than Calvin himself did. Another Calvinist.
Did you hear that? Did you hear it in the background? Let me just roll it back here just a second. You might want to crank it up just a little bit but see, I'm sort of wondering why anybody yells out, "That's right!" to a historical discussion.
Theology of Calvin further than Calvin himself did.
That's right.
Another Calvinist, a man named Jacobus Arminius, who was a pastor and professor of theology and a Calvinist, responded to some of the extremes to which Calvin's theology went. For instance, Arminius said, God is not the author of sin, as some Calvinism would teach. Arminius also said, God has not predestined some to go to hell, as some forms of Calvinism would teach.
Such as?
His followers in 1610 issued the Remonstrance, which was 5 points. And among those 5 points, he answered some of the extremes, but also he argued that it would be possible to lose your salvation. And so now today, when you hear the word Arminianism, you immediately identify it with the idea that Arminianism teaches that you can lose your salvation. Now, in response to the Remonstrance, the followers of Calvin's theology called the Synod of Dort in the Netherlands.
Now, I don't want to be mean here, but do you get the feeling that this is not exactly home turf for Dr. Vines? I just get the strong feeling that this is reading from somebody else's stuff. You know, it just doesn't seem to really be clicking here. And unfortunately, it also means that we're out of time on the program today. And so we're going to have to pick up at 1155.870 in the file. But like I said, I don't know that we're going to be doing this necessarily on the next portion of The Dividing Line. Because I want to address Reformation Sunday. But then again, maybe we will. We'll see what happens on Thursday afternoon when we gather again for The Dividing Line. See you then. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.